You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on May 11th, 2015, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss Marco Rubio's relationship with billionaire Norman Brahmin, and then the significance of Labour's defeat in the 2015 UK elections. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio, as usual, is Nate. Nate, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Later in the show, we're going to be talking about the outcome of the British elections, but we're starting off now in our first segment with a discussion about Marco Rubio following an article on his relationship with a billionaire in Miami. They're both operate in Miami mostly when Rubio's not in the U.S. Senate. And of course, Rubio is now running for president, so this relationship is coming under a lot more scrutiny. Now, certainly, this is somewhat different also because it's not just about, you know, the super PAC relationships, which has obviously been the big focus, I think, for the presidential election so far in terms of donors. This is about more of a personal relationship. So this is this guy named Norman Brahmin, I believe, right? And he was a billionaire car dealer, and maybe I guess still is, and a former owner of like the Philadelphia Eagles. And he has, you know, the positive aspect, if you want to call it that, you know, that's all above board, is that he has decided, actually before Rubio was even a senator, decided that he was going to personally make Marco Rubio the first Hispanic president of the United States. So, you know, he has goals and dreams, I guess. And, you know, but he's done a lot to personally support Marco Rubio in, you know, throughout his career and put him on this path. But it's not just about, you know, these donations. It's also about sort of financial support. And the question is, has he been getting, you know, untoward benefits back in the other direction, particularly when Rubio was in the state legislature?
Yeah, I'm just looking at some of the details here. I think it's going to be estimated that, I guess, by the end of the campaign, he'll have spent approximately $10 million overall on Rubio. So that's for things like financing his legislative agenda, just helping out to bankroll some of the campaigns. I think he's added to their personal finances just because of various campaign and office-related debt, I guess, for his, the Rubios and his wife.
The phrase in the Times article was that the rising politician and his wife, quote, grappled with heavy debt and big swings in their income. There was a period where Rubio was, I think, out of office or not getting paid or something like that, and in that period, he was technically a quote-unquote lawyer for Brahmin, doing unspecified, very lucrative work. And then almost immediately, you know, after he was sworn into the Senate, then Rubio's wife got hired in some position that she didn't appear to have any qualifications for some sort of foundation, I think, that Brahmin and his wife have. Yeah. And you know, things like Rubio sort of positions himself as saying, and I guess we can get into this a little bit too, as like, you know, that he's one of the least affluent senators, that he's definitely probably the least affluent of the people running for president of this, you know, at least the serious candidates, and that he, you know, doesn't have a lot of cash on hand, that kind of thing. But it's like, okay, well, you've got a lot of debt, you've got multiple houses. Most people don't have multiple houses, you know, if they're going to be complaining about having trouble making ends meet. But also, you know, I think this raises a question. I mean, we talk about, obviously, you know, some of these ultra wealthy candidates being out of touch, but the question is, do the non-wealthy candidates then have, you know, a different kind of conflict of interest like this? Is that, you know, what's the trade-off here? You know, I guess it's like the, you know, Kennedys being super rich were able to like distance themselves theoretically from untoward influences and therefore be, you know, active on anti-poverty issues and things like that, although I think that's a little bit mythologized.
Well, I'd also say the Kennedys had plenty of untoward influence, but we'll leave it at that. I think the issue here is more just the level of influence and the way it's being used. Okay, so we're seeing that there have been state taxpayer funds steered towards some of his pet projects, like he wants a $80 million state grant to finance a genomic center at a private university, $5 million cancer research at a Miami Institute where Brahm is a major donor. So you were seeing these pattern of things. And obviously, he's a huge philanthropist. So these are, I would say pretty worthy causes, obviously, cancer and genetic research. So that's not like the end of the world right there. But I mean, I guess you do just see a example of. The article ends with a discussion of the guy interviewing Brahman in his office, and he's like, oh, I don't think, really, I actually exert too many influence. I don't really ask for things necessarily from here. I only ask for some small favors, like, oh, the woman who does my daughter's nails had an immigration problem, so we got the office to help out with him. Actually, I have a friend who worked for Rubio, like in his Senate office. Like, I don't know if he, is taking favors for this guy or whatever. But and so it ends with one of his aides coming in and saying that the Florida Senate was about to vote on a bill that he had sought that would allow auto dealers greater leverage over car manufacturers. So, benefiting him. And the vote passed 30-4, and they're like fist pumping in the office, like getting really excited. So it's not like this is just philanthropy and just, oh, these were going to get delegated anyway. So, I mean, there is a clear level of influence here. And, that's just something. I mean, you have to pay attention to who's donating to these presidential candidates and who's bankrolling. Because this is less of a donation and more of this guy is the campaign in terms of its finances.
Right.
And, you should pay attention to what his views are. And because if Marco Rubio is elected president, this guy will have, I don't know if he'll have an official job, but he'll have certainly a role of influence.
Yeah, I mean, apparently the thing that originally brought them together, besides the fact that they're both, Miami area power players back several years, earlier in Rubio's career was Israel. And that seems to bring a lot of these donors in line with a lot of these Republican candidates.
Very interesting.
Yeah. And, like Nate said, right, something like a very large grant to cancer research or genomics, like those are things that are probably okay. They're philanthropic goals. They're not like personally.
Yeah,
benefit,
I mean, even with those, you could probably nitpick them and like question if this is the best use of. Okay, $80 million is a lot of money,
right?
And could that be going to a better university or more deserving one that's like at a cutting edge of a certain genomics program, and the money would take them over the top in order to. So like you could, there are a lot of things you could look at. And if you're seeing $80 million just thrown into a university that's not necessarily the most deserving, then that actually does raise some serious questions.
Right.
I don't know enough about the details maybe necessarily on that one to say it wasn't deserving. We can't give $80 million for that kind of research. But yeah, you don't want us to necessarily be nitpicking the details, but when you say $80 million, that's a lot of money.
Exactly. And it's the kind of thing where you want to be awarding that kind of money on a more objective basis rather than just, oh, this person has my
favoritism
ear. And there was another sort of feature or sub story in this article was about how Rubio had clashed with Jeb Bush. I mean, they're still clashing and they're running for president against each other. But Bush had tried to veto this grant initially, and then Rubio came back and got like a veto proof majority the next year or something like that, to make sure that this grant went through and openly said, I'm doing this because of, Brahman and he didn't necessarily like pressure me to do it, but of course I'm going to listen to him because he's so important and so influential. And that's the feature that keeps on ringing throughout this is that, it's these sort of small favoritism, these indirect sort of benefits, things like that, right? But Rubio insists that this has all been disclosed, that he's been open about it, that it's not a secret, and therefore it's okay. And I kind of referred to this as the John Roberts school of non-corruption based on some things that John Roberts has said in campaign finance decisions, where he basically thought, well, if there's no explicit, quid pro quo of money for favors and contracts, then it's not corrupt, right? And another sort of way of looking at this is, you know, there are allegations against other politicians, like people like Chris Christie, for what's called a pay-to-play scandal, where you're basically explicitly going out and saying, give us money and we'll do things
for
you.
Or we'll shut down the bridge.
Right. And in contrast, this is not pay-to-play, but Rubio is definitely willing to play as a thank you for all of the paying, right? You know, right. maybe he's not explicitly being asked when handed the money, but he's
obviously... Well, it's more of a sugar daddy type situation where it's not really you're shaking people down in for cash. That's a very New Jersey of you to, you know, that situation. This is more, I guess you could say it's very Miami. It's very, you know, you have the rich bankroller, the guy who's just going to give you all the money, and you just pretty much do what he wants. That's, I mean, that's fine. I don't know if they're breaking any rules, maybe, but
right, and
it's possible that they're not because of all the loopholes. So
yeah, that's the thing that keeps on sticking in my mind on this story, is that it's entirely possible that he's correct, that this is not in violation of any laws, you know, whether it's state laws or federal laws, things like that, that this is just a very influential guy with a lot of money and a close personal relationship, but he's not hiding it, and he's being open about the fact that he's like, yeah, I like this guy, therefore I'm going to, you know, do things, and maybe some of those things, like the smaller things about the immigration problem or the student that wanted a shot at military school, things like that, you know, that he's going to give special attention. Maybe that is questionable and really riding that ethical line. But I think it's interesting that how this is playing out relative to another previous presidential hopeful who is now going to prison instead of the White House, Governor Bob McDonnell from Virginia, right? That was a similar sort of thing where there was a close personal financial relationship with the governor and his wife versus, you know, Rubio and his wife, and then some particular big donor. Now, in that case, there was obviously some very blatant, you know, steering of state funds to things.
But... Well, I would say that, and also it almost seemed more like petty than this. You know what I'm saying? Because, like, weren't they taking a ton of stuff from the governor's mansion and, like, getting it bankrolled?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the specific
details.
And there
were, like, prom dresses and stuff like
that. I think I remember, like, them getting, like, whey protein and stuff bankrolled by the governor. And you're just like, they're getting the most random things here. It's pretty hilarious. But obviously, you know, you can't do that. So they got booted out and everything. But I mean, I thought that one was pretty funny. Just because, like, when they started listing all of the items, like, the various, like, shampoos and, like, just nutrition bars and stuff that are so ordinary, but you can imagine, like, the governor just, like, filling duffel bags and stuff with all these goodies, and they got, like, the Rolex and all that stuff. So
yeah,
that's a little more flashy, just gaudy stuff, just more typical petty corruption. This is maybe a little more explicit control.
It's like I said, it's almost pay to play, it's almost influence peddling, except that you're not actually peddling it, you're just giving it
out.
You're
just influenced.
Right. And exactly. Yeah. You're the influenced party, and you're not necessarily soliciting it or offering it one way or the other. You're just responding in a certain way.
Would Rubio be in the Senate at 43 if it wasn't for this guy? No.
Probably not. No. I mean, like, you know, they had the articles in here, the examples mentioned in this article, talking about the guy financing the upfront costs for Rubio's book. You know, all these candidates have to write a book or whatever, you know, to as like a pre-step on their presidential campaign path, kind of outlining their vision for America or whatever, right? And so he, you know, this guy financed the costs for that. I mean, that's exactly right, right? You know, that this guy has made it his personal mission to get Rubio into the White House. He's not hiding it or anything. He's, you know, just wants to help him out when, you know, however he can. And I guess, yeah, it's like, I don't know where the line is. And I mean, I guess it's the big difference here with, say, the Virginia example is that, again, Rubio's not hiding it, right? He's been very open about this since he was in the legislature, right? It doesn't seem to have ever concealed this, which I guess is, you know, that's politics 101, right? The cover-up is usually worse than the crime, so just don't cover it up, and then it's, you know, it'll blow over. You know, on the one hand, we've heard a lot of focus about the influence, untoward influence with the super PACs and everything, but it's like, this guy is, like, financially dependent on Brahman and has been, and then has been delivering, you know, we know he's been delivering things. It's not even speculative, like, what will he do as president? It's like, if he becomes president, he will do basically almost everything that Brahman wants. And that, you know, that's not even an open question. It's like, based on his track record and his attitude about this. I mean, there are quotes here. What is the conflict? I don't ever recall Norman Brahman ever asking for anything for himself, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of remarkable how blatant this is. But it also, as Nate said a few times here, it's like, well, is it illegal? I don't know. Do you think that this is going to become a bigger thing, though, in the presidential race? I mean, especially, I don't even see it becoming an issue in the primary, because it seems like a lot of the primary voters will just be like, well, it's just the free market or whatever. But on the other hand, you've also got that sort of populist anger, you know, even on the right, of saying like, well, the government's bought out by, to use the phrase that Brahman didn't want used, fat cats. Nate, do you see this becoming an issue for Rubio in the primary?
I mean, I don't know about in the primary. In the general, that could be an issue. Sort of tough to figure out what the sort of issues or fault lines will be in the Republican primary, just because it seems to be... I mean, obviously, there are things that you could point to. I mean, immigration, all this stuff. But I think Rubio's taken a fairly hard line on that kind of thing in the past. So, I just don't see him being relentlessly attacked on this in the primary, just because I'm guessing most other Republican candidates will have the exact same type of situation with rich donors. I don't know if it'll necessarily be one guy or it'll be a collection of guys. It's hard to say that other candidates will have the exact same situation, but probably similar situations. So maybe they don't necessarily want to highlight that.
And I guess if he gets to the general and Hillary's the nominee on the Democratic side, I mean, how is that? She's got her own sort of contributor issues.
Yeah, well, I'm sure
there'll
be attack ads and outside groups and stuff. I mean, it's all
I'm almost wondering if we've reached a point where it's mutually assured destruction, where every candidate has some sort of just horrifically out of the lines relationship with, like, that should be a disqualifier and just won't be because nobody can use it because they'll get attacked as well. I mean, short of somebody like Bernie Sanders, there aren't that many.
It works like that, though. I mean, just because the way that attack ads have proliferated, it's not like you can.
You just think everyone just fires them. Yeah.
Well, it's not.
Because the outside groups.
Like, what would you hold back on necessarily? Okay, well, we haven't heard a ton about Hillary's finances. It's more, I guess, about the Clinton Foundation's finances and Hillary's emails and all that stuff. So I don't know. We'll see if anything happens. And if indeed Hillary is the nominee.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's true. The Clintons definitely invented a lot of this sort of influence peddling.
Well,
stuff.
I mean, we talked about it before. What happens? We really want to start digging into the Clintons. But you would wonder whether that's going to be a theme or.
I wonder if President Rubio would bring back the, donors getting to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom. Remember that was a thing that they had to end up banning or whatever because the Clintons kept doing that in the 90s?
Yeah. I mean, it's all very, it's influence peddling. You pay money, you have money, you get what you want from the government. I mean, that's how it works. So,
right. Before we close out this segment, there is one other example that I want to talk about with regard to Rick Santorum, actually. And this is something that it came up a few months ago, but I had not noticed it until recently. The 2012 race, of course, we've talked about this before, his bid was sort of kept alive by these huge donations to the super PAC that was backing him or aligned with him by this guy, Foster Freeze, who's, I think, California or something like that. This, he's not, as billionaires go, he's not even that much of a billionaire, but, he's been a big backer of Rick Santorum. He's been a big backer of Scott Walker. Both of them are going to be running this year. Who knows where he's going to put his money between the two of them. But the really fascinating thing that he's been doing recently is financing Kurdish militias, apparently, against ISIS. Technically also he's been providing, blankets and whatever to Yazidi refugees. So that you can't really criticize him for. But then the other thing...
Well, if they were covered with smallpox, then maybe.
Okay. But the other thing that he's been doing is lobbying the government really hard of saying, like, we need to be giving more, like, advanced weapon systems to the Kurds and stuff like that. But he's not, ponying up for that. He's just, kind of giving them light supplies and everything and food resources. But
should lobby Israel to do it. I'm sure they'll be happy.
Yeah, well, we talked about this, I think, last summer, that Israel and the Kurdish regional government have been getting increasingly, close ties.
Well, there
with
you
each
go.
Other. But yeah, no, I mean, and
well, I mean, actually, just to jump off to the side a little bit, if you think about it, the Israelis and the Kurds kind of are like natural strategic allies, would you say?
Just yeah, because they're an embattled minority, yeah, exactly. militarized minority government. In the, yeah.
Yeah. Like existing in like quasi countries, like in sort of like dangerous regions. But, you know, so you could see why they might team up at a certain point.
Right. And also, some common enemies, you know, Kurdish oil, right? Who's willing to buy that? Probably the Israelis.
Probably.
But yeah, no, I thought that was just such a strange, like, weird twist out of all of these, like, weirdo billionaire guys that, you know, because it's like beyond even the Kochs, right? They're just sort of putting money out there. And in this case, it's to Scott Walker.
Well, this guy
but
is.
But then
a,
there's these sort of sub, these like lesser billionaires or whatever.
But the thing is, this guy is like, his thing is Israeli right wing politics. Like, that's his sort of upbringing background. Like, that's his main issue of concern. Rather, the Koch brothers are just sort of like.
Well, Sheldon Adelson's the one who's like.
Well, Adelson too, but he's in bed with, what, Huckabee or Santorum? I'm trying to remember.
No. Okay. So Fries backs Santorum and Walker. Adelson last time backed Gingrich.
Oh, he goes
with
Gingrich.
Sure,
that's right.
But yeah, no.
So that's sort of what I was meaning when other like primary candidates will have a similar situation where they just have a sugar daddy bankroll. Well, yeah, what I was saying, Koch brothers are more. They're very, I guess, libertarian focused, almost like big business and.
Well, that's why they're. I think that's why they're backing Walker. I'm pretty sure. But yeah, but Adelson apparently actually, I think, just bankrolled like most of the Likud campaign in Israel.
Yeah, that's
so,
not surprising.
Yeah, and like I think he finances an entire newspaper over there that's basically just a, like a pro Likud propaganda joint or whatever. But yeah, no, these
is it
these,
one of the major ones or
I think it's like a newer
Jerusalem
one.
Post?
That's, no, it's a newer one that's becoming like a, you know, that, but it's explicitly in the way that like a British paper is aligned with a specific party. It's like very like closely aligned, with sort of Likud and the right wing of Likud. But yeah, no, these donor webs are just getting more and more complicated and tied together. All right, well, we are going to take a break and be right back in just a few moments. We're going to be turning now to a different election, the British elections, in just a moment. We'll be right back from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to be talking now about the results of the British elections, which were held last week. This was a surprisingly convincing victory, although, you know, a fairly narrow margin in the end in terms of a majority for the Conservatives. I mean, it was expected that it was going to be, you know, a tie, a hung parliament. Nobody was going to have a majority. Maybe nobody was even going to be close to a majority in combination with any other party. Turned out the Conservatives won an outright majority, and they are expected to be in there for another 5 years. So, you know, a lot of the focus has been on kind of the, you know, what went wrong with the polling. But I think this, you know, there were a lot of sort of sub stories coming out of these results, sort of underlying that. You know, the huge one is Scotland, that all but three of the seats ended up getting taken by the Scottish Nationalist Party. You know, one seat to Labour, one seat to the Conservatives, one seat to the Liberal Democrats, and then everyone else, every other seat there went to them. But the SNP actually got less than 5% of the vote nationally, but, you know, it gets like 8 to 9% of the seats. And that sort of thing causes controversy when then you get like the Liberal Democrats getting, you know, 8 seats with 8% of the vote, or... sort of most prominently, UKIP got 3.8 million votes, 12.6% of the vote, and only got 1 seat. I think most people are probably actually pretty relieved about that unless they were supporting UKIP, but it does bring up some questions there about whether or not, you know, the UK has an even worse system than the US in terms of its, like, how its representative democracy works in practice on election day. But I think it also is worth remembering that there was a referendum, a national referendum held in May of 2011 on the alternative vote, which would be, you know, a sort of like a proportional system. And that failed very convincingly. 2/3 of the people who voted for that out of, you know, 19 million people voted against implementing that system. So for all of the complaints about how, you know, the Conservatives got a majority with just 36.9% of the vote, Britain indicated just a few years ago that they weren't interested in going to a different system. Nate, were you as surprised as everyone else seemed to be by how this ended up turning out?
Not extremely surprised, just because this sort of had seemed like the status quo in Britain for a while, and there wasn't a huge momentum to change it. I guess people sort of like Cameron, that he's not particularly abrasive or anything, and there wasn't a captivating Labour leader or strong Labour, like, change plan or anything like that, so I guess there wasn't the momentum or initiative to shake things up.
Yeah, it seemed like, maybe this is just me projecting biases here, but it seemed like for a lot of the folks on the left, or the Labour supporters in particular, I should specify, this sort of seemed to them like their 2004 election, that they were expecting there was no way that Cameron could get reelected, and, you know, had kind of not a great leader going into this, and then, you know, sharp geographic divisions on the outcomes, and then they're surprised on election night when they end up losing, essentially, and getting, you know, 5 more years of this. Obviously, I don't think Cameron's on the same level of, you know, incompetent terribleness as George W. Bush by any stretch, but that seemed to be sort of the reaction there. What were your thoughts on this sort of UKIP situation where they end up becoming the third biggest party in terms of votes, but only end up getting the one seat, you know, but also threatened various other, you know, conservative and Labour candidates, like we had talked about in the run-up to this election? I mean, is this, you know, the end of the party, or just the beginning? I mean, you know, is it better to have UKIP shut out like this, or does it just sort of conceal the problem by having a lot of right-wing conservatives, you know, inside the major party?
Well, one thing I would say is I'm actually a little surprised by the UKIP's choice of colors.
Yeah.
They're sort of purple and yellow, which is very interesting. Just way out there.
Yeah, I don't know where the purple came from.
Yeah, actually, I kind of like it. You know, it's not as garish and clashing as maybe you would think, actually. I mean, just it's weird. But yeah, I mean, just I'm sure there are Tory MPs with views that aren't all that far off some UKIP. Well, I guess there's only one MP, but, you know, party members and whatnot. But it's probably good they only have one member, you know. Probably don't want a bloc being formed or anything like that of these, it's tough exactly what to call them. Like, there's like the element of like the football hooliganism almost, I think, that's still there, like the skinhead aspect and you know, obviously the lingering resentment for multiracial Britain. So... I mean, there's that, too.
Yeah, I mean, because they had, for the past couple of years, had tried to present themselves as, oh, we're just skeptical of the European Union. Mm-hmm. But then it, like, very quickly transformed into, no, we just hate brown people. Like, you know, things like that, that they became more and more blatant as it got closer to the election. I don't know if that was desperation or they felt emboldened or whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, that shouldn't be too surprising if you sort of do a little research into who these guys are. And, of course, the general trends that we've talked about here of... just right-wing populism on the rise in both Europe and obviously here in the U.S. as well. Not quite to the same organized, outright, just blatant racist views that often get expressed in Europe. But, I mean, it's hard to say that there aren't similar currents and bubbling undertrends and stuff.
So. Yeah. Now, a lot of this, you know, some of the Labour supporters or whatever initially tried to say, oh, this is the fault of Scotland or the fault of SNP. But then it became quickly evident on election night that England was the real problem here for Labour, that, you know, even if you added together the SNP seats that used to be Labour with Labour's, you know, winnings everywhere else in the country, it just did not add up to anything close to a majority. And the Conservatives pretty much won this election solely on the strength of their performance in England. You know, literally, I think they got one seat outside of England or Wales. And, you know, they got more than that. That was smaller than their margin overall. So, you know, they basically just locked up England, and which is, I guess, a little bit more conservative, theoretically. And then that was, you know, how they got this majority unexpectedly. And it reminded me a little bit of the situation with Ireland, you know, back in the late 19th century, where you had that sort of Irish Home Rule movement and the various successor parties there that ended up achieving Irish independence. But they basically just acted as this, like, block in Parliament that was, you know, taking up a huge number of seats and could prevent legislation from going through or governments from being formed without their sort of influence. Here, in this case, the SNP is not going to get much influence. Although,
weren't Irish political rights often curtailed, even though they did have some members? Like, there wasn't, I guess they didn't have, full effect. I don't know. I'm trying to remember legislative details.
Right, I definitely agree. Like, the Irish situation, they were very objectively being oppressed more than Scotland.
I'll support those Irish, Independence Party type people. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
And there's tremendous history of sort of insurgency, almost like going back to the 1800s, 1700s in Ireland, against basically colonial British government there that was extremely brutal and set up like plantations and stuff. So,
and whereas Scotland, that was a voluntary union merger, and they,
I was in Scotland, I saw a reenactment of the battle. Where some poor Scottish guys got hacked down with broadswords. So,
I'm not saying
in the 1500s it wasn't so great.
Right.
I'm sure William Wallace didn't appreciate what happened.
Right. But the eventual merger, I mean, and today certainly Scotland is not being oppressed in the way that Ireland was being oppressed prior to it gaining independence. I'm just wondering sort of what the future of labor is here, because, they've got this sort of leftist nationalist party that's blocking them in Scotland, which means they then have to win in England, but England isn't as liberal as their sort of their backbench in Scotland was, like their deep reserve in Scotland that they used to be able to count on. What's the future of labor here? I mean, like, it's still nominally, I mean, it's literally called the Labor Party, and the unions are still given an influential role in terms of procedure, but it's like, is this really it for the, social democratic, Marxian labor or whatever in Britain? I mean, they were never that extreme, compared to a lot of their European peers,
you had New Labor, which obviously was sort of changed things up a little bit in the 90s. We think New Labor is well and truly buried at this point. I think they need to look towards a new model beyond that, new labor.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they all showed up like after the election to basically be like, we lost this election because you left behind New Labor or whatever. And it's like, I agree with you. I don't think that was the problem. I think neither of these is working. There needs to be some other thing here. I'm not calling for triangulation, but they need to rethink
New Labor is a form of triangulation, really.
And that's what I'm saying is I'm saying it's, I'm not saying triangulate between those two factors, right? I'm saying I think this is going to be true for a lot of these parties. It's like, I'm not saying give up on all the goals or anything like that. Far from it. But I'm saying I don't know. We might have to seriously start thinking about what does, a left-wing party look like in a post-industrial democracy you don't have these, industrial labor movements.
Yeah, plus the thing is that the fact that obviously the industrial labor movement is just, everything is changing due to the just technology and the economy, obviously, and there's less need for a giant labor force. I will say the context and politics are somewhat different in, as you mentioned, post-industrial Western European countries, where the context for 60 years has been democratic socialism. You are seeing some free market right-wing parties get elected, but it's not necessarily an instant rejection or moving away. Because, you even see in Germany, it's not like Merkel and those guys are completely abandoning elements of the welfare state. It's not like there's like this somehow fundamental struggle for, their political existence or just the political essential elements. I think there's still a consensus for elements of sort of a democratic socialism, but they're also seeing the financial and budget effects and other things like that, where it needs to be tweaked. It needs to be modernized. All these things, maybe you do look at taking some power away from the unions. Like, there are all sorts of ways you can tweak this while not necessarily abandoning stuff like NHS. So it's, I think the challenge for labor and other left-wing parties in the future will be how to reconcile sort of the core beliefs of their longstanding movement with, just in order to appeal to some people who may be, in the middle between the parties. And, I'm not saying, as you said, not saying triangulation, but you sort of have to find a new message that can actually really appeal to people. And you can sort of have, new policies going forward. Like, this is what we're going to do to, you know, okay, conservatives say, oh, we're spending too much money, blah, 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 on these things. And then you can say, okay, we're not going to spend it on that, but we're going to spend it on this thing that, you know, will help more people. And it, you can more easily connect it to the voters and the people that would really need it. So it's I think it's a tricky situation, but it's not like, this is still Europe we're talking about. It's not like there's going to be some fundamental overnight change in just sort of the welfare politics of the continent, basically.
Yeah. Now, I mean, you know, you had the Blairites popping up and parroting that phrase that Tony Blair literally said back in like December or January, which I don't think, as a former party leader, he should not have come out and said something like this. But he said, you know, traditional Labour Party against a traditional Conservative Party will have a traditional result. Like he, you know, trying to say that the party was, you know, screwing up and should have been doing more stuff like what he was doing. But it's like, I don't think that was working either. I think part of the problem was that the party hadn't made a decision on which way it was going. I think they were torn between these impulses of trying to campaign to the SNP's left in Scotland, but then trying to assuage business concerns in England. And, and they're still, like, for some reason, they're still catering to these business people that are probably never going to support them short of, you know, another Tony Blair type showing up or whatever. And even then, they'll be pretty skeptical. It's like if they're convinced that you're going to bring about a Marxist revolution in Anglo-Saxon, you know, financial England or whatever, like, that's stupid. So why are you trying to, like, convince, like, make them feel better and hold their hand or whatever? Like, they're not going to give you money to run your campaign and they're not going to support you. And like, why not just really lean against that and say, look, like, these people, like, it's okay to be wealthy, but you can't hide it in tax, you know, havens. You can't, like, you know, be accepting corrupt money from Russian oligarchs and Gulf barons or whatever, and, you know, like, bring up stuff like that, right?
Well, I think most of Europe is actually run by Russian oligarchs and Gulf barons, if the Premier League is any indication, so.
Right. But, you know, I just, like, yeah, they need to sort of pivot to, like, acknowledging that there's, like you said, not this large industrial working class base anymore. And, you know, it's in some areas of the country, there's still some left. But, like, yeah, there's a new economy here. A lot of that's going to be sort of white collar, you know, service jobs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I just think they need to target their sort of fundamental message more towards that type of worker or that type of economic reality rather than just, like, men in a factory, you know, hitting things with hammers and stuff.
I mean,
I'm not saying that's what they're doing, but it needs to be sort of a more modern focus.
Right. And by the same token, I think this is a problem that the Democrats have run into, especially under the Clintons here, is trying too hard to go after those upper middle class, you know, white voters who are never going to vote for you.
You, like, undermine your own message, too, with the people that actually would be maybe more receptive to a more blue collar message if you start really targeting the white collar guys. And it's kind of like, well, these guys don't represent me either. So,
right,
they might be less likely to vote or do whatever. It just, you have to really be careful with triangulation. And I'm not really a fan of it in general. So.
Yeah. So I think the consensus here, and I think there's probably a lot of this cross applies to Democrats, is it's like, you know, they need to reorient and retune what they're focused on and who they're focusing on in terms of the electorate. But that's not to say, you know, become a more center-right party or something like that. It's just a matter of acknowledging sort of changed economic realities, and then figuring out, okay, well, what does that, you know, post-industrial society mean for the, you know, values that we as a social democratic party want to, you know, bring to the table if we're brought back into government. But, you know, by the same token, I think there's been a little bit too much of the hand-wringing in some quarters, especially in other European countries, of saying, like, well, you know, we just can't afford to give out these generous, you know, benefits and whatever else, like, you know, that those days are over and we've got to really tighten our belts permanently and rethink our whole. And it's like, okay, well, like, let's not get run away with ourselves here, because there's still a lot of money out there. It's not like the world economy is dramatically smaller now, even adjusted for the size of the population relative to what it was, you know, in 1950 or so, right? Like, it's certain things are going to cost more. That's true. And there's more people. That's also true. Although in some countries it's getting actually smaller. But it's like, that doesn't mean, you know, let's cut all of our social programs and things like that, because a lot of it's like, well, why don't we work a little bit harder on cracking down on tax avoidance, tax evasion, people, you know, moving their money around different countries to hide it. And it's like, those guys are definitely getting much, much wealthier. Like, where did all the money go? It went to them and they're not paying the taxes on it, right? So I think that's something that really needs to be focused on here. And I know that, you know, the conservative and Republican governments in these countries do not like to do that. But it's like, you know, that's something that, yeah, that's a prime example where labor could be like, yeah, we're never going to win over the guy who wants to avoid taxes. So just like, just openly campaign against tax avoidance.
It's so easy to monger on that too, because I mean, no one likes those guys trying to just like, you set up your bank in the Cayman Islands. Like, I don't think they're known for their, you know, particular accounting practices down there. And the only real reason why you do that, we're not talking about Switzerland necessarily. I don't think there are quite taxes there too. So maybe that's an imperfect example. But at least the guys in Switzerland, you know, like they've got nice banks and they've got desks and they're not going to lose your money. Cayman Islands, I mean, who knows what's going on down there. So
yeah. And so
probably embezzlement and stealing and stuff, but whatever.
Right. And so it's like globalization has obviously made it easier for, you know, there's been a lot of great things, but the negatives have been that you get these sort of negative spaces between the authority of different governments where someone can basically squirrel away money between them and like, oh, well, whose jurisdiction? Right. It's like, whose jurisdiction is that? Is that your jurisdiction? Is that my jurisdiction? Well, you know, I like these rich donors to my campaign, so I'm just going to pretend that that's your jurisdiction and not worry about it. But you're also doing the same thing.
Yeah, just look the other way.
Right. And so it's like, this kind of thing is where the money is going. If you're like, we don't have the money for these things anymore. No, you would have the money if you had an international system to crack down on this stuff. And, you know, I'm sure some people are saying, well, that's just never going to happen. And it's like, okay, but it's the same thing with climate change, right? There's a lot of these problems now that are global level problems, and we're just sort of refusing to deal with them because they involve international, you know, cooperation and efforts and giving up certain amounts of sovereignty. And I know the UKIP folks definitely don't like that, but I don't really care about their opinions. But it's like, this is my sort of point in all of this is like, you know, if you're going to rethink these parties, that doesn't mean rethinking the whole structure of your, you know, your social welfare state, because there is money to pay for those things. You just have to be willing to go and get it. And I think that's sort of the challenge that labor faced, was not making a decision. And I hate to sound like the, you know, the crazy right-wing Republicans who are always saying like, you know, well, our party, you know, it failed. George W. Bush failed because he wasn't conservative enough, or, you know, such and such candidate didn't do it right because they didn't, you know, they left the conservative principles behind, right? I don't want to sound like that. But I do think that there is room to be more solidly left leaning on these things and you know, arguably populist, but it's not populist in a bad way. I think that's another thing that's been kind of blurred, is this like characterizing populism as automatically negative. And it's like, well, there's bad populism and then there's good populism.
And I'm actually pretty anti-populist in a lot of ways, just because I think you start going into just demagoguery territory and sort of just trying to almost scapegoat people. And I mean, it almost plays to a sort of like, it's anti-intellectual in a lot of ways, and it'll just sort of play to these, I don't know, kind of nasty undercurrents. But in turn, when you're talking about just sort of populist issues in on the political spectrum, rather than sort of the whole culture of it, it's more of a, you know, these are issues that could you know, actually impact and you know, have a or at least the imaging of them when you talk about the tax avoidance, tax shelters, but it will play to just ordinary people that, you know, are not privileged, part of this global elite that are able to set up these bank accounts. And, you know, if we're talking about this in a European context, you know, it's not like, I'm trying to think, there's not like there's massive income disparities, but there are certainly just sort of an average, almost middle class of people. There are certainly poor, richer spectrum of that. But I feel like then there's that, and then you sort of move up to the extremely wealthy. It isn't as much of a huge broad spectrum, maybe. It's more equal overall. So if you sort of play into the, I'm not going to say jealousy, but I guess maybe some resentment towards the uber rich for hiding all their money, then that could be an effective strategy. So I'm just like trying to add up the
right,
what the impact would be if you are able to effectively target that group of voters.
Right. And I think you bring up a good point, which is that you have to be able to separate out, sort of, for lack of a better phrasing, cultural populism from, you know, economic broad-based populism, things that are genuine, like genuine real issues that impact a lot of people or could play to a lot of people. Because at the end of the day, like, what is the point of having a democracy if you're not trying to serve, you know, a broad, you know, group of people or whatever,
you
right?
Serve the people that give you the money, and that's not necessarily always going to be the person that, you know, needs it or is in need of your political help the most. So
right.
That's unfortunate. I mean, obviously, we're just talking about in the last segment, the extreme influence that billionaires will have over candidates for president, almost making them presidents.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we have to hope that, you know, there's the legislatures will, and they'll recognize potential political points to be gained by actually doing the right thing sometimes. And, you know, whether it's a populist issue or whatever, you know, actually going after a combination of, okay, are we going to actually help people in general and score political points? Because sometimes those things don't line up. So I think there could be a benefit to, and we're not talking about like stealing away all the money ever made by corporations and forcing them to pay like 100% taxes or anything like that. It's just, it gets a little ridiculous when you're hiding like all of your income in non-taxable like ghost accounts, basically. And I mean, some taxes in Europe are admittedly very high, so I'm not necessarily saying that they should have to pay like 50% or anything crazy like that, but
right, there's a balance to be found.
There's so much like dark money out there.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, I mean, it frustrates me to a certain extent where some of these economic policies are written off as quote unquote populist, and it's like, okay, yeah, and like there's like. This, you know, people get all snooty about, oh, well, you know, people are just going to use a democracy to vote themselves more resources or whatever. And it's like, okay, well, do you want the 80% of the population to get the resources, or do you want the, you know, 1% of the population to get the resources? Like, what, at a certain point, somebody is always voting themselves money through democratic means. The question is, can you make that be sort of more broadly based and aimed at a wider segment of the population? And obviously, I think, you know, everyone should want to be helping to get people, you know, out of the lower classes and up into the middle class, because the first thing people do once they get into the middle class is, don't take this away from me. So, you know, they're like, that's a natural, if you can get people up to a certain standard of living, that naturally is going to kick in some safeguards. It's not like you're just going to endlessly take away all of the money, you know, from a wider and wider vacuum and give it to, you know, fewer and fewer people at the bottom of the spectrum. Like, that's never happened ever and is probably never going to happen. But yeah, so anyway, these are just sort of some of our thoughts on like what labor and, you know, by extension, the Democratic Party here in the U.S., some of those, you know, lessons that could be learned from this election, although it's obviously not you know, perfectly intercompatible. All right. Well, Nate, that's going to bring us to the end of our show this week. Thanks again for joining me in studio.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.